Today, well, it's all coming unglued. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one with this post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined once again by Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
I'm all right. it's a funny old world out there, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly all happening. You know, I think that we've reached a point where it's really just like an end of an era. You know, the sort of post Cold War world of, you know, I'm not going to call it, you know, a single power, but just, you know, that type of world order where everything just sort of seems to just, you know, we just sort of seem to be able to fumble our way through. Just seems to be coming to a bit of an end, and we're approaching a time of some rather profound challenges.
Well, it is very interesting. I mean, the fact that Germany has now accelerated its defence spending dramatically, it will be probably something like the third largest defence force in the world. That's a remarkable shift. The Fed, of course, has turned turtle and lifted rates. In China, they've actually announced more stimulus to try and save the economy. And locally, Freidenberg is basically going to throw more money at households just before the election. So wherever you look, there are reversals and things changing and chaos rules, really.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that one of the key things about that is that, you know, we've still got this narrative that everything's strong, everything's fine, everything's going to be super resilient. But their actions speak to a much, much greater series of challenges, that things are perhaps a lot more going to be a lot more difficult than the consensus would suggest. And I mean, that's even just evolved, I think, in the last, you know, 24 hours. I mean, you had Macron, who's the French president, come out today and say that, well, but basically that there's going to be a major food crisis in Africa. And I don't think it would be, you know, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that that is going to be an issue in other parts of the world as well, at least in terms of just not so much in terms of access to food itself. It's just the fact of how much is it going to cost.
Well, that's right. So there are some countries that are very directly connected to, you know, corn exports and sunflower oil exports from Ukraine, which will probably stop. But of course, they'll have to compete then on the global markets with crops from other sources. So that's going to put significant upward pressure. And it's worth just reflecting that we've still got, if you take, you know, African countries, for example, or Middle Eastern countries, still significant COVID infections running there. The vaccination rates are very low. Economic activity not very good. And then you've got a lot of people who will be extremely exposed to high prices. So, you know, on a global basis, you can see, again, more of the same old, that the old order is just fading, and you wonder what's going to replace it.
Well, that's something that you and I have been talking about now for over 2 years since all this pandemic stuff first kicked off. You know, there is going to be some rather significant changes, and I think that while that we were already on that particular course, the conflict between Russia and Ukraine is obviously going to accelerate that significantly, because you know, there are nations in the world that get almost 100% of their wheat from Ukraine and Russia. You know, there's going to be all of these second, third, fourth order consequences of the conflict that we can only begin to speculate on, let alone begin to actually fully understand what's going to happen. And I mean, you know, I'll give you just a very short example. Like, say, for example, there are issues in, say, West Africa, and that is resulting from higher food prices. There is, you know, issues politically, issues with social unrest, and that ends up cutting off the export of a key commodity. Now, that commodity price is going to rise, and then that is going to feed into prices, into inflation, into markets, and it's also going to impact other nations around it, because obviously you've got a nation undergoing a revolution or wide-scale civil unrest. So that's just one little microcosm of what could result from this, except it's something that could occur potentially throughout the world. So, you know, I think it's very easy to see how this could turn into something, well, quite challenging and quite widespread.
Well, that's true. And I'll give you another little microcosm, the nickel exchange in London, the London Metal Exchange, right? Because, of course, they basically had to turn the exchange off because the price had shot through the roof. It's interesting that nickel was continued to be traded in Shanghai, and so you had this massive disconnect between those two markets. Well, they tried to turn it back on the last couple of days, and then basically had to turn it off again because of the price drops. And it shows you how dysfunctional these financial markets are. Now, I don't think the nickel market is particularly unique. I would argue that a lot of other financial markets are also as dysfunctional. It's just that we don't see it being displayed as clearly. But again, I think the financial markets are all over the place too.
Well, I think that the nickel market is just a perfect example of some of the issues that are present within global markets more broadly. I mean, they literally turned the market off and reversed a large series of trades worth billions upon billions of dollars. So some Chinese tycoon who was shorting the market wouldn't get wiped out and wouldn't end up owing all the brokers who he did his deals with, like JP Morgan, like BNP Paribas, billions upon billions of dollars. Because obviously, you know, well, that would be quite a shock. And it's just ridiculous that we have reached that point now where the market makers can just wave their magic wand, erase billions of dollars worth of trade, and somehow, you know, like, don't get me wrong, that people are up in arms about this, but like, what are you really going to do about it? You know, and the question is like, is that going to happen with other markets? You know, are we going to see other markets where, you know, someone's going to get wiped out, someone's going to get smashed by a huge margin call, and then all of a sudden we're just going to change the rules for them again as well?
Well, that's the point, really. And of course, it's all about derivatives, right? So the relationship between the underlying and derivatives is part of the problem here, that people are taking positions and, as you say, are shorting. In other words, they have an expectation about the fact that prices will drop, and therefore they're trying to position themselves to profit from that. And it goes back to one of the fundamental problems we have in the financial system and the financial plumbing, which is that effectively all the market speculation, all the market positioning is swamping real life activity. And interestingly, of course, up till very recently, the Federal Reserve and other central banks have done everything possible to protect the financial system. Now, you know, the old Fed put is worth exploring here, right? Because effectively, up until very recently, everyone assumed that if markets fell, the Fed would intervene. I would just pose the question, how far will markets have to fall before the Fed intervenes? There is a point at which they will.
There is, but I mean, at the moment, there was a survey done by the Bank of America of fund managers at what level they believe the Fed will intervene. Now, they concluded on an aggregate basis that it would be about 3,600 on the S&P 500. Now, that's entirely possible. You know, I mean, the Fed is obviously an entirely subjective thing. It's not something where there's any real, you know, science or, you know, quantitative data that you could actually, you know, used to really more accurately guide your thinking on it. But I think that as long as markets remain orderly, as long as, you know, you don't see these issues with in the treasury market, in the bond market, I'm not really sure that the Fed will intervene at that point. I think that if it's going to be a slow grind down, you know, over a period of, you know, 6, 12, 18 months, I don't really think there's any reason for the Fed to intervene. Because if anything, the falling market is going to do the Fed's job in terms of putting some downward pressure on inflation. So as long as things don't start falling to bits, maybe the Fed will just sort of, you know, sit back and just go, well, you know, normal market conditions have resumed, deal with it.
Yeah, and he did actually refer again to assets still significantly overpriced relative to perhaps where they should be. So that was a tacit nod that actually maybe asset prices should correct. Property holders, please note. Stock market holders, please note. Traders, please note. Right, that's a warning sign.
Well, exactly. I mean, and that's something that that Macro Alf on Twitter mentioned about, you know, his read on Powell's statement. Just that basically that the Fed's neutral rate, you know, that they may be willing to go above what they consider neutral. And neutral, I believe, at the moment is considered around about sort of 2%. And if they're willing to go higher than neutral sooner rather than later, that's obviously going to put downward pressure on asset prices. But, you know, by the same token, as I mentioned before, that could potentially put downward pressure. Well, it will put downward pressure on inflation. So, you know, that could be a trade-off that they're willing to make. At the end of the day, it's about their number one issue is inflation, and that is what they need to control.
Absolutely. Well, that's the clear turnaround from even 3 months ago or even 6 months ago, right? The transitory inflation is now the most critical issue on the table, right? And in fact, if you listen to the press conference, as I did, the battle against inflation was just repeated again and again and again through that press conference. It was like a mantra, right? So he's clearly got the message that that's actually what the markets wanted to hear.
Well, exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to be about the bond market. You know, stocks would be nice if they can, you know, if they can keep propping that up, they'd love to. But at the end of the day, it's about the bond market, and they need to provide credible evidence that they are going to act on inflation, because if they don't, the bond market will do it for them. And I think it's interesting that despite all of the issues in Ukraine, the issues with, I mean, even if you look at the yield curve, you know, into 2023, 2024, you know, the euro dollar curve is starting to price in rate cuts already, you know, and we've only just had rate liftoff. So I think it's interesting in that regard that, you know, it could all go pear shaped, you know, relatively quickly.
Yeah, well, we might talk a bit more about yield curves. I'm sure you've got some interesting charts to explore some of these things a bit further. But just to say that if you look out along the yield curve, it's a funny shape at the moment.
It is indeed. So shall we get started with the charts?
I think we should.
Okay. Well, you know, here we go with Jerome Powell trying to put out the inflation fire that he's helped create. All the charts for this week are available at avidcom.substack.com. If you would like to subscribe and get those articles in your inbox, either usually once a week or once a fortnight, that would be very much appreciated. Okay, now I thought we'd start with Australia for a change. Normally we finish on it, so I figured that we'd do something a little bit different. And basically there are rate hikes as far as the eye can see. And I mean, personally, I don't think this is going to happen. I think that long before we get to anything like 2.4%, things are going to start breaking in the economy. But this is what the market's pricing, and it's going to be interesting to see how Governor Lowe decides to guide monetary policy in the coming months.
Well, let me just highlight there, right? If in fact the rate is, you know, 2.3% in August 2023, right, which is a massive rise, that would suggest a 30% fall at least in property prices. That would suggest a considerable number of the banks would have difficulty with their property portfolios, and probably some bailouts and things like that would be on the table. I can't see how those rates can possibly translate into reality without everything blowing up.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting question, though, isn't it? Because I mean, we're in a situation whereby normality no longer applies in some ways. For example, the idea is that if we got to 4% unemployment, we would have fantastic wage growth. And in the past, when we had 4% unemployment, wage growth was absolutely great. At this point, we can't even generate inflation adjusted wage growth. We wages are going backwards, despite the fact that we've had the most ideal conditions for wage growth over the past couple of years in terms of massive stimulus and closed borders. So that raises a question. Is it possible that we could see the RBA or the Fed, more likely the Fed, let's be honest, continue to hike into a recession or into a slowdown? You know, it's a question that ultimately has to be asked, because if we are going to see all these other factors continuing to drive inflation, continuing to drive workers to demand higher wages, you know, we could see that stagflationary scenario, but with rate hikes.
Well, that's right. And just to give you a quick rule of thumb, you know, if you had a mortgage at 1.99% and it went up to a 3%, your monthly repayments over the same term would go up by 15%, right? And if your mortgage went from 1.99% to 4%, your mortgage repayments would go up by 30%. And that is because of the mathematical situation where, with rates so low, it's the interest component that's growing so quickly. Now, can you imagine mortgage repayments going up by that amount and it not being a problem? I mean, you know, it's not even fathomable, right? It's going to cause considerable amount. So the issue for the local central bank here is they know this. They know that people are actually quite sensitive to rate changes, not least because the mortgage rates are very low at the moment and the mortgages are very big. So the question is, will they, you know, sit on their hands and try and muddle through without doing stuff, or will they actually lift the rate? And it's interesting, each time Phil Lowe's come out, he's sort of more conceded that rate hikes are more likely. So he's sort of moving from his 2024 target, you know, closer in. And of course, CBA is saying it'll be June.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how that particular battle unfolds, because, I mean, economists throughout the, you know, throughout the nation are calling for rate hikes, you know, some for as early as April. You know, that's what they're saying, when it should happen, not when it will, obviously. But, you know, I think the latest now is about August, September. So, but by the same token, I just think, one, it's going to be interesting, because by then the Fed would have hiked 3, 4, 5 times by August. And secondly, it's just going to be interesting, because technically speaking, the recent run-up in commodity prices has given Lowe more ammunition to sit on his hands.
Yep.
Because you know, it doesn't really matter if the differential between short-term Aussie bonds and short-term US bonds, you know, starts to put downward pressure on the dollar, because the dollar is getting stronger. So that does give him some scope, at least on paper, to do nothing. And I mean, for all we know, you know, we could see the global economy enter a recession by the time we hit September. So, you know, it's really all up in the air in that regard.
Well, plus I wouldn't be surprised to see a term funding facility version 2, which would actually allow the banks to be able to get their profits supported, which would perhaps help them through some of those painful sort of times as well.
Well, wouldn't it be nice if we had a government or a political party that could be in power that would oppose that? Would oppose using the resources of the Australian taxpayer to prop up the profits of the banking sector?
Well, I'm not sure that either of the big parties would stand up for that, but maybe if there's some coalition or some combination of minor parties, they could have a bit of an influence and make it a little bit more bumpy. And of course, it's interesting, Guy DeBell's are hopped off now, so the deputy, the governor, so I'm not even sure who's going to necessarily be there to be able to answer all the questions in the Senate.
Well, it's gonna be interesting to watch, and we should probably move on to the next slide before we're here all day again. This is what I was mentioning before. Basically, inflation-adjusted wage growth is at its worst level in decades. If you know, aside from the very very brief shock at the beginning of the pandemic, and ironically, even that big drop there in the year 2000, that was because of the GST. And if you strip out the introduction of the GST and the immediate aftermath of that, Australian wage growth is going backwards at the fastest rate in decades and decades. And that's one of the things that really gets me when people say, oh, but the economy's doing so well, unemployment's so low. It's like, yes, but most households are going backwards. That is not good news.
No, absolutely. And, you know, again, I see it in my surveys. So the stress surveys are as bad as they've been. And while some people have had wages increases, it's particular industry segments and particular types of people, the bulk of people are still going backwards in real terms, to say nothing of the costs.
Indeed. Now, I thought this was interesting, because here in Australia, we rely on equity, mate. We rely on people borrowing money against the growing equity in their property in order to, you know, fund consumption, in order to inject cash into their small business and any number of other endeavors. Now, we all heard in The Big Short and in the commentary at the time that Americans were using their homes as ATMs during the run-up to the crisis. Now, what I've done here is I've taken the rolling annual average of US home equity withdrawals as a percentage of GDP and just overlaid them over that particular period. Now, US home equity withdrawals as a percentage of GDP peaked around 2.65% and actually started falling fairly significantly before we even got to the financial crisis, before we had the Lehman Brothers moment. It had fell by roughly, actually over 2/3 by that point. And then obviously it fell away again when the financial crisis occurred. So I just think it's interesting to look at that as an analog for what could happen to Australia if we, for whatever reason, saw our equity mate levels start to drop off. Say, for example, if interest rates rose.
Yeah, and the latest number is a big number, isn't it? The amount of equity that's been withdrawn out of the property sector thanks to the fact that property prices have been rising.
It is, and here we go. Here in Australia, as I said before, in the US, home equity withdrawals peaked at 2.65% of GDP. Here in Australia, they are currently 4.65% of GDP. So, despite the fact that Australians spent the better part of 2008 and 2009 mocking Americans for using their homes as ATMs and for being irresponsible with their mortgages and with their debts, we are borrowing almost twice as much against our homes in terms of equity withdrawals. But it also goes to show that if we were to follow a similar path, which I've charted here, over time it would fall from over 4.5% of GDP to less than 0.5% of GDP. And you don't need to be an economist to know that if you take 4% cash worth 4% out of GDP per year out of the economy, that you're going to have a recession.
Right, and that's about 50 bill at the moment, is it? 4.5%?
No, 93.
93. Oh, sorry. Yes, you're right. 93.
93.
Okay. I was getting it muddled up with the amount of job keeper stuff that was thrown out, right? Because so what we're saying is there was more drawn from home equity than from the main government scheme through
Yeah.
COVID.
That's one of the things I like to contrast this with is the Rudd government's GFC stimulus. Now, that is about a quarter of this. Even if you adjust it for inflation, you adjust it for GDP, etc. It's less than a quarter of this than what we're pulling out of our homes and injecting into the economy. So, it just if that was enough to help tip the economy, tip the balance of the economy in conjunction with the Chinese, and the mining boom, etc. If that was enough to tip the economy back into positivity, what is something four times that size going to do if and when it reverses?
Yeah, and of course, don't forget the superannuation withdrawals as well, which was an additional pool of funds.
Well, exactly. And those funds are still being spent to this day.
Exactly, and that's where some of that money that, of course, the Treasury keeps talking about—the 250 billion of savings. Well, guess where it's come from, right? It's come from our superannuation. It's come from government payments, and it's come from pulling down equity on properties for those who have it. But I keep having to make the point, Tarek, it's not equally distributed, right? It's not like everybody is sitting on an equal share of that huge pool of wealth, right? It's horribly distorted towards a relatively small proportion of the population.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. The head of the Food Bank Australia, I forget exactly which one, but I'll see if I can find the link and send it to you. But they said recently that 1 million Australians are relying on their services. 1 million, that is an absolutely insane. Considering the fact that you probably don't have people from the same household, I mean, that's something like what, 6%, 7% of people relying on food banks? And that's just an ad, and that's people who are willing to go and do that because, I mean, I've personally been in that position, and it is not a nice thing to have to do to be put in that position where you need to go and you need to ask for help like that. And it's just a truly astounding number of people, considering the fact that you've got Scott Morrison, Josh Frydenberg, and the cadre of certain economists who are saying it's just the best economy ever.
Yeah, and about a quarter of Australians don't have 1 month's savings available. So in other words, if they, for any reason, had an interruption in their income within a month, they would be in deep difficulty. I mean, that's the sort of quantums we're talking about, right? So, unfortunately, all of the narrative about how great the economy is, it's looking at a very narrow slice through the economy. And my own sense is you've got this polarization between the affluent ones at the top end who are doing reasonably well and feeling quite rich because the stock markets have done quite well. But down the other end, you've got a lot of people who are really, really struggling. You've got some people sort of in the middle now, in no man's land, and probably actually drifting more towards the bottom than the top of the pile, as it were.
Well, as long as people are not seeing pay rises, and well over 60% of people aren't, according to the latest data, it's going to be challenging for households because not only that, but that's versus CPI inflation. We're talking about what it's the wages going backwards versus the CPI. If you want to talk about, say, for example, what say SQM's rental index is saying, or CoreLogic's rental index is saying, rents are rising by, you know, 8, 9, 10% per year. And, you know, let's not even get started on what home prices are doing. You know, that should matter, but it doesn't because we don't count it.
Oh, well, that's right. And non-discretionary costs are rising much more than the CPI, you know, 5 or 6 or what, you know, whatever number you'd like to pick. It's a lot, lot higher. And, of course, the most recent changes to fuel will also have a very significant impact too.
Indeed. Now, this is an interesting one because it plays into something that you and I have been discussing over the last couple of years, how you know, the inflation-deflation debate, because you can have a whole heap of inflation, but then what ends up happening over time is companies will order more because they think the demand will continue, and they order more and more and more and more until you end up with a glut of inventory. Now, I'm not saying that that is what has occurred just yet, but the US has started to see inventories building well above trend, particularly in the last few months. So if that is met with a significant slowdown in consumer spending, in activity, et cetera, you could start to see some deflationary pressures begin to appear in consumer goods, which could be really quite interesting, because it's going to be interesting to see how it balances out against those, as you say, those necessary things like food and energy.
Yes, and of course the whole point about what people spend money on is quite important, insofar that if people are tight, they will spend it on the stuff they have to spend it on, which means that some of the other goods that they would like to spend it on don't get spent anymore, and that could have a very significant impact on those inventories that are being restocked up post the supply chain disruptions. If people stop buying certain more luxury goods, that will be a very significant impact on the overall GDP.
Indeed, and I think that one of the things as well is that there's a lot of different factors now. You know, you are starting to see these supply chain issues get, I'm not going to say fixed because they're not, but they are starting to improve somewhat. Like, for example, you know, the wait times at LA Long Beach Port has come down in a big way, but part of that is also due to seasonality. Yep. You know, people, they've already restocked at the start, towards the end of last year, start of this year. But you are starting to see some improvement. However, you're now seeing the impact of the issues with Russia and Ukraine. So, you, for example, neon. You know, people think of it as like the lights in Vegas and stuff like that. But it's actually a key component in manufacturing computer chips. So, you know, there's the very real risk. And well, not risk, it'll happen. There, you know, we will see further supply chain issues as a result of this. And it's going to be interesting to see how that balances out against these inventory builds, because we don't know how big and how prolonged these supply chain issues are going to last. You know, are the sanctions going to hit Russia? Is Russia going to hit back and counter, you know, by expanding the number of exports that it's going to withhold? Like, for example, Russia is now refusing to export fertilizer to unfriendly countries, yet Europe sources 25% of its fertilizer from Russia. So, you know, there's all these different things, all these different factors, but we don't really know how they're going to come out in the end. I mean, I think we can safely say that it's going to be rather unpleasant.
Well, you know, I was listening to somebody yesterday suggesting that Russia could decide to turn the oil off to Europe and the gas off to Europe as sort of a last resort, as it were. Although, of course, at the moment, the fact of the matter is that a lot of the funding for what Russia is doing is actually being paid for by Europe, because they're still paying for the gas and the oil.
Well, the oil is an interesting one, because Russia is currently struggling to sell a lot of their oil. I mean, there's pre-existing contracts. There's contracts to countries like China who really don't care. They just want their oil. But there is oil from the Urals that Russian oil companies are trying to sell for up to $30 a barrel discounts, and no one's touching it with a 10-foot pole. Now, part of that is the fact that getting insurance on a ship in the northern half of the Black Sea, considering the ongoing conflict, is basically impossible. And that's one of the issues with this conflict becoming prolonged. The longer it lasts, the longer you're not going to be able to see shipping go into the northern half of the Black Sea to pick up wheat, to pick up corn, to pick up oil, to pick up LNG, etc. So you know, there's all these different things. And, you know, for all we know, the war could go on for another 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. We don't know. It could be over in 4 hours. It could be over in 4 years. It's just, I mean, probably not 4 years, let's be honest. I think they'll be more than a little bit tired by then. But, you know, even four months, you know, that's long enough for the Russians to be forced to switch off oil production and to rely on just selling off their reserves. So, you know, and that in and of itself could be, you know, create quite a series of challenges.
It's worth noting also that Russia didn't default on its bond payments.
Probably thanks to the oil and the gas money.
Funny that.
Now, this one I think is quite interesting because there's this idea out there that everyone's bearish on the market, that everyone's so bearish that the market can only go up. But if you actually look at futures positioning, market makers are generally long. They are, you know, roughly as bullish on the market by this particular metric as they have been at any point over the past 12 years. So, you know, I think that there's a far more complex picture at work here in markets than some of the commentary and the basic things like the CNN Fear and Greed Index would suggest.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. There is a lot more going on below the waterline than a lot of people, I think, realize. And it's interesting listening to some of the major players and how they're thinking about it relative to some of the retail players who are sort of, you know, a bit more jumpy and jumping up and down and following around. Also, I'd make the point, Tarek, as I made before, a lot of the market position currently is to do with where the futures and options prices are as well, because people are trying to take positions to trade volatility. So you've got to strip some of that out to really understand what's really going on. This particular chart that you've shown is actually quite a powerful one because it actually gives you quite a lot of a sense of what's really going on rather than what might be written about in some of the newspapers.
Yeah, it's actually, I really like this one. If anyone, I apologize to her because I forget her name, but if you want to follow the creator of this chart, there'll be a link in the description with a link to all the charts, and there'll be a source in there. So if you want to follow her, she has some great content like this. And, you know, I think she's a worthy Twitter follow. Okay. Now I know that the vast majority of you already know this, but unfortunately the market, or not so much the market, but there are people on Wall Street who says, oh, but the war in Ukraine won't be in that inflationary. Here's this chart from Vietnam. Here's this chart from the Gulf War. But they don't fundamentally seem to understand that this is a war that is significantly impacting trade in a big, big way. This isn't like the Gulf War or Vietnam, which is isolated to, at best, second or third tier power, and this is a clash of the superpowers. And not only that, but Russia is one of the largest commodity exporters on the face of the planet. So, as this shows, once you start interrupting trade, inflation starts to take off relatively quickly. It doesn't take very long. I mean, like you can see there, even during the U.S. Civil War, when the supply chains were obviously much, much longer, things took a lot longer to transport. You can see how quickly these things take off. I mean, even there when you can see where the American involvement in World War I begins in 1917, it can take off very, very quickly. And with the way that the globalized world now functions, that could feed into things, you know, in Australia and into things throughout the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And the point about the inflationary forces, it's partly, as you say, trade disruption. It's also about how different goods become much more prioritized compared with previously. So there's not necessarily an equal distribution of all types of commodities, right? So some become ever more critical, like some foodstuffs, and others become less critical. So not only does it change the fundamental supply demand, but it also actually changes the mix. And that's something that people perhaps don't always recognize when you sort of see these situations. As you say, this is not just a small Ukraine-based problem, right? This is a global problem now.
It is. And I think that it's also the fact that the world, we've got ourselves as a species, we've got ourselves in a bit of a pickle. There's a lot of us. we don't have the resources, even as it stands, to support the population, you know, to adequately support the population. We're consuming, what is it, 1.4, 1.5 Earth's worth of resources every year. And the issue with that is even relatively small disruptions. People go, oh, well, even if you take Ukraine out of the equation, that's only like 8% of seaborne grain exports. And let's say that, you know, they managed to export, you know, 3-4% of that via, you know, rail into Europe, you know, past the war zones, you know, around the Black Sea. That's still 4% of global grain. You can't take 4% of global grain out of the equation and expect there not to be problems. And at the very least, significantly higher prices.
Well, remember, grain prices were already accelerating before the Ukraine conflict.
Yeah, exactly. And here we go. Now, then there needs to be something said about the chart there on the left. World grain stockpiles have come down, not too much, but they've come down by about 50 million tons since 2016, 2017. However, the key point with this with this particular chart is that it doesn't break down who holds those grain stockpiles. Now, depending on the particular grain you're talking about, whether you're talking about wheat, corn, rice, etc., China holds up to 70% of some of those grain reserves. 70% of all of those grain reserves, despite the fact that China has roughly 1/5 of the world's population, they hold 70% of the grain reserves. Oh, sorry, up to 70% of those grain reserves. And not only that, but the Chinese agriculture minister recently came out and said that the conditions for wheat could be the worst in history, and that China could have major issues in terms of growing as much grain as it initially intended. So China's going to want to buy more grain. They're going to potentially look to dip into their reserves or to look to other sources. So obviously that's going to place greater upward pressure on wheat than is already there.
And I suppose there's an argument to say, well, Australia might benefit from that because, of course, we are a producer of wheat, and quite a lot of what we produce goes overseas. And I suppose if the price is higher, then that would actually help our terms of trade.
Technically, yes. I concur. And we could benefit from quite a lot of different things. You know, I mean, if there are various supply chain interruptions to things like, you know, to iron ore, to coal, to, you know, even some precious metals, you know, which obviously a lot come from Russia, but by the same token, we are a consumer driven economy, you know, and while we may get an extra couple of billion a year from, say, for example, higher grain prices, I think that the inflationary pressures on consumers and how that's going to crimp consumer spending is probably going to be the more significant factor for the broader economy. However, it could also support the dollar.
Yeah, well, of course, the dollar's been somewhat stronger more recently, and that's partly all of those factors. And it's interesting, again, going back to what Frydenberg briefly mentioned today. I mean, the budget's not for a week and a half or whatever, but there is definitely a suggestion of funding coming to help households with cost of living pressures. The timing, of course, being perfect because of the election within, a couple of months?
Well, I do wonder what form that's going to take. I mean, obviously, the Liberal ideology would drive it towards tax cuts or some form of offset, but I mean, who knows? I mean, we've seen the government splash cash like no other government in Australian history over the last couple of years.
And of course, with the polls showing Labor so far ahead, they might pull a few rabbits out of the hat and you know, basically throw money at people to try and get them to change their mind.
Well, if only it was their money and not our money.
I was going to say, whose money is it? Yeah, exactly.
Okay, this shows basically just how absolutely key Russia and Ukraine are to global grain supplies. They are about a quarter. And there's also issues as well in the sense that, say, for example, Argentina, which is another major grain supplier for the world, they've recently stopped exports of soy and soy oil, which... it gives you some sort of an idea of what potential limits we could see from other nations. You know, is Argentina going to see the rising wheat prices there? Obviously, you know, going to have issues with their own people, with their cost of living. Are they going to potentially start to limit exports in order to drive down prices? And that's something that we're starting to see in countries around the world. You know, the Italians are talking about it. Morocco has already limited some exports. Hungary has already limited grain exports. You know, the problem is that once you start to see things descend into it's every nation for themselves, it becomes even more challenging, even though, a government's first duty is to look after its own people, not global markets.
No, well, that's true, of course. And it's worth just reflecting with regard to Ukraine that sunflower oil, they're even a bigger supplier of sunflower oil on a global platform than corn.
Yeah, and that's also having the knock-on effect as well because, you've got Ukraine, they provide, wheat, corn, etc. But as nations, as companies, as households are forced to find alternatives to, say, high wheat, high flour prices, they turn to other things. They turn to rice, or in the case of sunflower oil, they turn to palm oil and other options there. So that then puts upward pressure on those commodities, which then creates even more problems. So it's not just, oh crap, wheat prices are going to be high and then everyone's, it's okay, everyone can eat rice. You know, it's going to be quite a bit more challenging than that.
Yeah, the knock-on effect, absolutely.
Now, this really illustrates just what an absolutely huge problem this could grow into for the developing world. Because as the graph on the right shows, there are countries like Somalia, like Benin, that import all of their wheat from Russia or Ukraine. Now, even if you look at the graph in terms of even like countries that import, say, 50%, countries like Tunisia, countries like Uganda, that is going to be pretty hard for them to replace. And even if they can find a replacement on a short enough timeline to fulfill these original purchases, it's potentially going to be at a significantly higher price. And, this is the fuel of revolutions. You know, if you look at something like the Arab Spring, you look at the French Revolution, at the heart, it's often about the price of food.
Absolutely. But there's also a broader point here. Okay. Over the last 2 or 3 years, a lot of investment managers have been investing quite heavily in, quote, emerging markets, right? And emerging markets includes places like Russia, right, and Ukraine, but also a lot of those other ones on the list there, right? So there's a very interesting knock-on effect from all of this, not only in terms of, the sort of the physical, but also in the financial. In fact, the financial system could well be under stresses and strains as well, because some of these emerging markets could well find that they're going backwards.
Indeed, and there is that contagion issue. I mean, an interesting example is the aircraft that the Russians have. I mean, I suppose the technical term is stolen, but I mean, I suppose, you could say appropriated, that they were leasing from companies in Europe, but they've now just said, well, we're keeping them. You guys have hit us with sanctions, so this is our way of hitting back, and these are ours. And there's something about like 500 aircraft. But you think about those, the people who've had the debt that's secured against those aircraft, because everything's packaged up and sold. That's just the way things work in today's financialized world. And I mean, who's going to pay for those? Who's going to pay for the tens of billions of dollars worth of, aircraft that the Russians have appropriated? Or then there's the fact that there's all these Russian companies that owe tens of billions of dollars to European banks, particularly the ones in Italy. I believe that the total was about 24 billion dollars or 24 billion euros. And that could be a rather significant problem because, someone always has to pay.
And in fact, of course, if you are an investment manager and you happen to have assets in Russia, which you're now going to have to write down, right? Well, those aren't your assets. They're actually the assets that you're managing for your investors, which essentially means that the investors, i.e., your superannuation fund, for example, could be hit. And who picks up the tag ultimately from these? Well, it's going to be the investors. It's going to be your superannuation funds. They're going to be written down by whatever proportion is exposed to those markets. And again, it's all going back to this wonderful web that we've got where everything's interconnected, right? Nothing is actually isolated. So it can actually flow through to performance of superannuation funds.
Indeed. I mean, even if you look, like I said, about the issue of of further issues in developing nations as a result of these high food prices. You know, there are plenty of countries, you know, not just Russia, where investment funds have invested very heavily. And, you know, that is going to be a problem. I mean, the supply of commodities is going to potentially be a problem. So, you know, it's hard to know how all this is going to snowball, because, you know, who owes what to who is also another side of it as well. Because, you know, are you going to see some of these investment funds become insolvent, and then who do they owe money to? And then you've got, you know, the potential for a solvency crisis.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds horribly like the global financial crisis, when effectively that's precisely what happened, because suddenly everybody, you didn't know quite what other people were holding and what they were holding, how were assets of good quality or not. And there was the confidence level drifted down a lot lower, and that then created the next round of cascading failures. We're not a million miles off that sort of scenario now, I think.
No, we're not. And we're also in a situation now where we are much closer to 2008 than to 2020 in terms of policy settings as well. Because at the start of 2020, they just unleashed a huge wave of liquidity, a huge wave of fiscal stimulus, you know, was unleashed to protect markets. I mean, that's mostly what it was about. You know, and to attempt to protect economies. And now they can't do that again. I mean, technically speaking, they can do what they like, but they can't do it without consequence, like they, you know, without relative short-term consequences like they could in 2020. If they want to turn around and throw another trillion, $2 trillion at the US economy, it's only going to stoke inflation more. And I mean, like you see around the world, you know, I mean, perhaps this is something that Josh Frydenberg will do, but, you know, they're giving out these subsidies to people, you know, because fuel prices are high. Say for in California, they're giving people, you know, up to $400. You know, in France, they're giving people hundreds of euros in order to help pay for their heating bills. But that, again, as you know, as positive and as, I'm not going to call it targeted, because generally they're not, but, you know, these policies are also inflationary. And that's the problem, you know, going forward. You know, we economic data is in the rearview mirror. So even if you have a contractionary quarter, you know, the people at the Fed might be thinking, oh, well, there might be a recession, but, you know, we probably should keep targeting inflation. And that's generally the way they've always done it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you say, it's rearview mirror, and in fact, it's lagged rearview mirrors, right? It's a long way behind. And the other point, of course, is that when you pull one of those levers and you throw more liquidity into the system or whatever, it takes time for that to work through. In any case, like it doesn't happen tomorrow afternoon. It just takes time. So quite often there's huge latency between the actions and the consequences, which means that it's always quite difficult. And the fact is that federal banks have not had a hugely positive track record of making forecasts that actually fit what actually happens in any case. So it's not a huge amount of science, I think, in my view.
No, I mean, have you seen the RBA's wage forecast? I mean, they're
Yeah.
fantastic, right?
Hey. That'll be true one day.
Oh, I think that might, you know, just break the universe. You know, it's like dividing by zero.
Exactly right.
Okay, this is the last one for the day, and it paints quite a concerning picture. Like, say for example, in Nigeria, almost 60% of consumer spending is done on food. You know, if you see the cost of staples rise, you know, 40, 50, 60%, it's going to push people to the wall relatively quickly. And, you know, I mean, obviously you can see Australia down in the bottom right there, where, you know, we spend about 6-7% of household consumption on food. But it just goes to show how different, how bifurcated the world is going to become based on the challenges that we may face. Because for the Western world, we're relatively okay. We're all going to get very annoyed at how much our food is costing, you know, at the cost of petrol, etc. But at the end of the day, it's not life or death for the vast majority of us. But for people in the developing world, where food is a much greater proportion of incomes, where, where a 30 or 40% increase is the difference between being able to feed your family and not, that's where we're going to see some very serious challenges.
Yeah, and I would make one point about that sort of distribution chart. You could actually apply a somewhat similar analysis at a more granular level to households across Australia. Because whilst it might be 5 or 6% on average, there are some households who are paying a lot more of their disposable income on food and on shelter. You know, so 60-70% on shelter and then the rest on food. There's nothing left over at all. And one of the concerns I always have with these sort of averaging numbers is it masks these really big differences that you see. And unfortunately, a lot of those people who are spending a lot of their disposable income on just food and shelter of some sort are often those less able to be vociferous and less able to really have an influence on, you know, broader policies and what have you. And in fact, many politicians tend to ignore that sector of the voting sector. You know, there's enough in the other sector to actually go after. So there's a big silent bulk of people in Australia who are already doing it really tough. And, you know, all the things that we've been talking about in terms of higher inflation and food costs, that is the sector of the population that's going to be really badly hit.
No, I concur. I mean, while obviously the majority of people won't say take it in their stride, but they'll be able to deal with it without too much interruption to their lives. You're right. I mean, it's like we're talking about before. You know, there are a million people who are already relying on food banks. So, you know, if the cost of food goes up 20-25%, that number could rise significantly. And then you've also got the other side of things, which is just the issue with rising interest rates. You know, I mean, you know, you've got, I mean, what was it that the bank saying to go to the food bank so you can keep paying your mortgage?
Oh, yes. Yeah, exactly right. Well, that shows you where their priorities are, right?
Well, I mean, was there really ever any doubt? You know, I mean,
no.
When what do you like to say about the banks that people are just a series of ongoing cash flows?
Yeah, that's right. As long as you go on paying something, right? I mean, CBA announced today 3,000 businesses are being forgiven their loans for next 3 months or something, right, to help them through the floods. Now, that sounds at one level very altruistic, but of course it's in the bank's own interest because they can then say, well, those loans are not now out of condition because basically we've foregone that deliberately, so they'll just push it out, right? So it is in their interests as well. And I guess if they then lobby the Reserve Bank saying, well, you know, we've helped people out, give us some more cheap money.
You know, sometimes I sort of wish that you and I were just cynical. You know, this is just how you and I saw the world, and that we were completely wrong and that none of this actually ever happened. But unfortunately, it's the world we live in. You know, like, it's interesting. You know, people say, oh, you know, you need to be, you know, like, sometimes there are people like, oh, you know, you're so negative. And I'm like, I just feel like saying, it's like, well, we've got the largest war in Europe since 1945. We've got the beginnings of a global food crisis. We've got the potential for enormous market crash because they're so out of touch with the underlying fundamentals that may occur if we do get a global recession. And I'm just like, well, I actually think we're being rather positive.
Well, you know, I always say I like to try and be as realistic as I can, right? So, you know, if there are good news stories, we'll celebrate the good news stories. But also we have to be realistic about what's really going on and to try and highlight some of those things. And I'll also make this other point to Tarek, that if you go to some of the other news channels, the mainstream news channels, they just give you the full sort of on good news story. You know, so the unemployment rate was ultra low and that was a very good sign for the economy, and the terms of trade are doing really well, our exchange rate's doing really well, you know, etc., etc., etc. And the point there is that is not wrong, but it is not the complete story. So what we're trying to do here is to try and give a bit more balance to some of those things, to try and say, well, hang on a moment, there are some other things you need to think about too, to really get a realistic view of what's going on. And I guess the final point is that, of course, politicians will tend to veer towards the positive because, of course, they are trying to get that feel-good factor ahead of the poll which, you know, whenever that is. So they don't really want to talk about this negative stuff. So if you listen carefully to the way that they talk about some of the ABS statistics, they will pick the bits from the ABS statistics that will actually be the positive bit. Give you an example, the unemployment numbers, right, at 4%. No one actually asked them a question about the fact that we've actually got 500,000 overseas people that disappeared, right? So, in fact, net migration is, pretty much negative at the moment. Or, indeed, the fact that the mix of jobs has changed and a lot of people who are in work are now in work that's paying very poorly, so that they actually are officially working but are still working poor. Now, none of those things came up in any of the commentary that I saw anywhere on the employment numbers. And I don't know why that is, because that, for me, is part of the story.
No, I concur. And I think that the key thing about, you know, the challenges that we face in this world is that they should be confronted. We should stare them down, assess them, and deal with them. You know, I mean, like, you know, you and I have been talking about the potential for, you know, for issues with food price inflation since, wow, I think it'd be almost 2 years now, you know, since they were dumping, you know, vegetables out in the fields to rot and dumping milk down the drain. Now, it's about looking at these things and seeing them for what they are. You know, yes, it's unpleasant. I don't like it any more than anyone does. I mean, it's horrible seeing these things coming. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, hey, now it's happening. Now it's horrible. But it's about preparing for that. And, you know, hopefully, you know, hoping that somehow that someone in power will perhaps, you know, take the time to listen. You know, I mean, you know, I just hope, you know, you just hope against hope that somehow things will be resolved for the better.
Well, I've got the view, Tarek, that, you know, there has to be some groundswell from ordinary Australians, right? Because there is a really important story here about where we should be investing for the future and how we should be investing and what our policy levers should be. And they are not the ones that are currently on offer from either of the major parties. So through this next election cycle, there should be a better debate. And if we can facilitate some of that better debate by using some of the data and some of the ideas that we've explored, then that, for me, is good. I'm not trying to sort of, you know, completely convert the country to a different way of thinking, but I think there are some really, really important questions that should be asked of our politicians and our other leaders, which would actually take us to potentially a better place, which would be good for everybody.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's what it's all about. You know, it's about trying... It's about pointing out the issues to try and work towards a better future. Even if that better future is just accepting the reality of a situation and then being able to better move on with your life rather than getting blindsided by it down the road. And I mean, I just hope that somehow some of these issues, like, say, for example, we were talking about the issue of rents, you know, that can become a major political issue, because, you know, a third of the population rent. And they deserve to have the issues that are facing them talked about, and to be confronted by the government, not just ignored.
Well, unfortunately, we know that the supply side report on housing came out today, and they basically said, "Well, that's fine. Feel free to use superannuation, except, you know, we'll give some money to the states to make them a little bit more accountable for building more of the." You know, affordable housing. I mean, none of the critical issues that should have been addressed were addressed, as expected. Another classic example of a missed opportunity again, because, well, the agenda got set the wrong way right at the beginning.
Yeah, well, it either gets set wrong at the beginning or it ends up being, what's the word that can keep me out of trouble here? It ends up being a little bit, well, shall we say, altered towards the end? You know, say, yes. Like, you know, so for example, the Banking Royal Commission.
Yep.
You know, made all these recommendations, and then they just went, oh, we don't need those. Yep. You know, we don't need to keep. You know, we should be taking away lending standards. We shouldn't be leaving them in place.
Well, that's right. Unfortunately, the political overlay distorts things that actually could make a huge difference if they were actually followed through on. And again, we see the same things where the political assumptions and the political ideals are actually front and center. And all of those critical issues that were raised and should be raised just get swept to one side. And part of it, of course, is the political cycle because it's too short, but also there is an ideological issue here too. So what we're trying to do is lift the veil a little bit and help people perhaps make better bets on things of the future and to realise that there are other important questions that need to be addressed.
Yeah. And, you know, just on a personal note, you know, I've always just thought that, you know, happiness and fulfillment is starts at home. You know, like I know that a lot of people take on the challenges of the world, and I realize that to a degree for some people that's necessary. But the more that you tie your fulfillment and your happiness to the outcomes of the world, the more challenging it can be at times. And but the last 2 years have shown that, you know, if you wear your heart on your sleeve and you feel all the suffering of all the people in the world that they're all going through these challenges, it's going to be hard. And I just think that, and I think that we just as people, it's good to focus on our families and our communities and achieving positive change where we can, even if everything else is going to hell on the outside.
I think that's very good advice, Tarek. You know, you can't get weighed down by the whole world because it'll crush you, right? But you know, look for those things that you can change locally, and also, I have to say, in my particular situation, walking the dogs, best medicine there is.
Yeah, exactly, mate. It's about doing the little things that keep you going, even when things get really, really tough. You know, like, I mean, I know, obviously, you know, you've been through an incredibly difficult time recently, but, you know, just for everyone, it's about finding those things that help you pick yourself up and dust yourself off and keep going, because that's what it's all about. It's about, you know, being in the game.
Absolutely. Well, tip for the day, walk a dog. Tarek, great to talk. As always, thank you very much. We'll do it again soon.
Yeah, no worries, mate. Looking forward to it.
See ya. Take care.
Bye, mate.